Weak, Marissa said. 8. Eric Mocker spent his day going through every business file of Christian St. Clair's business dealings, then his own files. In St. Clair's, he found the offer for the Carlson Clinic buyout and its deadline. He read it carefully, then called Dr. Willie Keeling, the head of the Stockholders Association. "Good morning, Dr. Keeling."
"Good morning, and who might this be?"
"I am Eric Mocker." He spelled the name slowly. "Does that ring a bell?"
"I'm afraid not, and I don't have time to talk right now.
This is about the buyout offer from St. Clair Enterprises. I believe you have that in hand, and I am the successor of Christian St. Clair."
"Ah, yes, I heard of his death and thought that might be an end to this business."
"Certainly not. The offer is still a valid one, and you have 3 weeks to state your intentions."
"And what will happen if we do not accept the offer by that time?"
"Then the offer will be withdrawn, and another made, but at a lower price."
Mr. Mocker, I must tell you that I expect another offer, a better one, by that time."
"From whom, may I ask?"
"You may not."
"Good day, sir."
Keeling hung up. Of all the occasional irritants in Mocker's life, which he fought every day to remove, being hung up on by someone who didn't know him was right at the top. He felt his gorge rising and fought to keep it down, taking deep breaths.
"I believe he was getting angry," Keeling said to his companion, Herbert Fisher, an attorney with Woodman and Weld.
"You handled him perfectly," Herbie said. "First, by not acknowledging him, then by continuing not to acknowledge him, then by disclosing that you could do better, and finally by hanging up on him. Just perfect. Now he knows he has a fight on his hands."
"I don't like having someone, even someone I don't know, angry with me," Keeling said, wiping his glasses with a tissue, then patting his forehead and under his eyes.
"That is because you are a professional man and not a businessman. Businessmen are accustomed to dealing with people who are displeased with them and often use that to their advantage."
"And how do I do that?"
"First, wait for his response."
"How do you know he will respond?"
"Because he wants the Carlson Clinic. Perhaps even more than St. Clair himself wanted it, because it is probably the first business transaction he will carry out in his new position of authority."
"Will he want to hurt me?" Keeling asked.
"No. Oh, he may be angry enough to do so, but he is businessman enough to know that violence would damage his position and thus cost him money and prestige with his board. He will be scrupulously polite until he isn't, and that will let you know that it is time to deal with him."
"When will he call again?"
"Perhaps soon, perhaps later. It doesn't matter. When he calls, ask your secretary to say that you are unavailable, and she doesn't know when you will be."
"I don't have a secretary."
"Dr. Keeling, do you have a telephone answering machine?"
"No."
"I will send one over to you and have it set up. After that, never answer the phone unless you recognize the calling number as being someone you wish to speak to."
Herbie used his cell to ask his secretary to send over a machine pronto.
"It should be only a few minutes."
The phone rang again, and Herbie held up a hand when Keeling started to answer. On the sixth ring, he picked it up himself.
"Hello," he said, sounding bored.
"May I speak to Dr. Keeling, please?"
"Who's calling?"
"Eric Mocker. Can you spell that?"
Mocker spelled it slowly and carefully.
"Is that Eric with a C?"
"No, with a K."
"And Maker with a K, too?"
"It's Mocker with a C-H."
"Who are you?"
"I am the chief executive officer of St. Clair Enterprises," Mocker said through gritted teeth.
What is that? It is a very large business conglomerate. What kind of business? Financial. Does Dr. Keeling know you? I spoke to him 5 minutes ago.
What is this about?
It's a business matter.
What sort of business?
Extremely important business. Just a minute. I'll get him.
Herbie pressed the hold button.
If it were me calling, Keeling said, I would want to kill you by now.
Oh, good, Herbie said.
He waited for about a count of 10, then pressed the line button.
Hello?
Hello.
Is that Mr. Maker?
This is Mr. Mocker. May I speak to Dr. Keeling, please?
He just left.
What do you mean?
I mean he just went out.
How long ago?
Just a second.
Did you tell him I was calling?
I called after him, but I think that, what with the sound of the car starting, he may not have heard me.
When will he be back?
I don't know. Sometimes he's gone for hours, even days.
Who is this speaking?
This is his nephew, Herbert.
May I leave a message for Dr. Keeling?
Just a second. I'll have to find a pencil.
Herbie pressed the hold button. Keeling burst out laughing.
You should take all my calls.
Herbie pressed the button again.
I'm sorry, I can't find a pencil. You'll have to call back later.
He hung up. Mocker threw the telephone across the room.
9. Stone landed at Teterboro, and he was halfway back to the city when his cell phone rang.
Hello?
Stone, it's Herb Fisher. Are you back yet?
Almost. I'll be home in half an hour.
Good. I've got a team ransacking the books and files at the Carlson Clinic, and they should have everything we need by the end of the day.
Good.
Oh, and Dr. Keeling heard from Eric Mocker.
And how did that go?
Herbie gave him an account of the conversations.
I've got an answering machine installed at his place now, so he won't have to talk to Mocker.
Good. Let's keep the guy guessing.
I wouldn't be surprised if he makes another offer before the deadline.
You think we're driving him that crazy? Stone asked.
Yes, I think we are.
There's something I'd like for you to do as soon as your people are finished at the clinic. I'd like to know how much cash the Carlsons have on hand, or can borrow on short notice.
Ah, I think I see your point. You want them to make an offer to buy the non-family shareholders' stock.
Right. If I'm guessing correctly, some will tender their shares, others won't, Stone said.
And it may be possible for the Carlsons to regain a majority of the shares without using steel to effect a buyout. I want you to figure out how much the family can afford to offer the shareholders.
And you want them to make an offer big enough to be off-putting to Mocker.
Absolutely right.
And how will Bill Eggers feel about all the billable hours the firm will lose by not going the steel route?
He can console himself knowing that he's done the right thing for his clients.
I'll be sure to mention that to him when he blows his stack.
Don't worry, your position will be unassailable. Call me when you have the numbers in order. They hung up.
Fred dropped Stone at home, then continued uptown to the Bichetti's apartment house. Stone entered the house through the office door and found Joan looking bored.
Obviously, I'm not keeping you busy enough, he said.
Yes, I just love being overworked when you're here. Your mail and messages are on your desk. Welcome home.
Stone ran through the messages and found one from Marissa Carlson, confirming his appointment for his flight physical. And he asked Joan to cancel his earlier appointment with his old FAA doctor.
So, who's this Dr. Carlson? Joan asked.
It's a name you will hear often for the next few days or weeks. New client.
The Carlson Clinic?
Correct.
Very Tony.
Yes, indeed.
Stone showed up on time at the Carlson Clinic for his medical exam. The clinic was housed in a large limestone-faced building, not as large as other New York hospitals, but imposing. He checked in at the front desk and was immediately sent to the 14th floor. Marissa Carlson's office was a combination of an examination room with the required table, scale, and drawers and cupboards for supplies, and a modern and very personal office, with bookcases, comfortable furniture, and a door that led somewhere. He had been there for about a minute when she walked in and closed the reception area door behind her.
"Good morning, Stone," she said.
"Good morning, Marissa."
"I've got your application on my computer," she said, "and we sent the blood sample you left to our lab, and we have the results. So why don't we get started by reviewing your listed medications?"
"All right."
"That won't take long, because you're taking only a statin and a daily aspirin."
"Correct."
She consulted a sheet of paper. "And your cholesterol is at 150. What was it before the statin?"
"240.
"So it's working?"
"Yep."
"All your blood work is in the normal range, so strip down to your shorts and have a seat on the table."
She began running through her checklist, chatting as she did so.
"What do you fly?"
"A Citation CJ3 Plus. You?"
"A Citation 2. It's our family airplane. My father and my brothers also fly it."
"I flew an M2 before the CJ3.
"Why did you move up?"
"Someone accelerated the decision process by placing a bomb in the M2. I ordered the CJ3 the same day."
"Does that sort of thing often happen to you?"
"Not all that often, but more often than I'd like."
"Where do you fly it?"
"Among my several houses here and there. I have a place in England, so I can fly the CJ3 non-stop from Newfoundland to Shannon with a decent tailwind, although I have to return via the Azores. You?"
"We fly to the yacht, wherever it is, and on vacations and business trips, and among our five branches." She continued moving down the checklist, then stopped and pulled on a latex glove and grabbed a tube of lubricant. "Okay, shorts down, please, and on your knees on the step."
"Well," he said, complying, "you've already seen me naked."
He flinched a little as the exam continued. Then she handed him a tissue. "Let's do the eye exam," she said, pointing at the chart. "Read me the lowest line you can manage." He did so. Then she checked his peripheral vision. "That's it. You pass. You can get dressed."
He did so. "Marissa, now that we're on intimate terms, do you think we could have dinner one night soon?" She laughed, then signed his certificate and handed it to him.
"What a nice idea."
"Tomorrow evening?"
"Perfect."
"Where do you live?"
"One floor up," she said. "You'll need to take the elevator to this floor, then ring the bell on the elevator with the mahogany door. Then it will open. I'm in apartment 3.
"How convenient."
"Why don't we have a drink at my place, then continue? Say 7 o'clock?
"You're on."
10. Stone had a message waiting from Herbie Fisher when he returned to his office.
"What's up, Herb?"
"The Carlsons have the wherewithal and the borrowing power to buy out the non-family stockholders. Once they've got a line of credit with their bankers, all we need do is draft a letter and some forms telling the stockholders that they're offering 50% more than St. Clair, and if they want to sell, to sign the documents, have them notarized, and a check will be on the way."
50% more?
"That's my recommendation. It's enough to impress the stockholders and to simultaneously warn Mocker that he's in a bidding war. If we can get this done in a hurry, they can make it a fait accompli before the St. Clair time limit is up."
"Then set up a meeting with the Carlsons as soon as possible and let's outline it for them."
"I can do it late tomorrow afternoon."
"That's good for me."
"I'll make the call."
5 minutes later,
Herbie called back. 5:30 tomorrow in the elder Dr. Carlson's office. You're on. They hung up. A convenient time, Stone thought. Joan buzzed him.
Dino on one.
Stone pressed the button. Dino?
None other. I ran Eric Marker through the computer. Ready?
Ready.
He's 49 years old, born in Queens, educated in the public schools. 4 years at Fordham, where he was introduced by a priest to a CIA recruiter. He vanished into the agency, did his 20 years, took his government pension, and fled the premises. I don't know what he did while he was there.
I know. He was in covert ops and had a reputation as an assassin.
Training he put to use, if what we already know about him is true.
Right.
He had a couple of brushes with the law along the way, a barroom fight that he won all too handily, charges dismissed when his victim refused to testify against him. The other was more serious. A woman accused him of rape, and the DA had a good case, but the victim left town before they could haul Marker into court. The case just sat there until the statute of limitations ran out.
Anybody ever hear from the woman again?
Nope.
You think he used his agency-acquired skills to make sure she didn't show up?
Would you be surprised?
Dino asked. Nope.
Me neither. He would have done serious time if it had gone to trial.
So he's clean?
Yep. I'm sure St. Clair would have checked before he hired him.
I'm sure he did, Stone replied. And I'll bet St. Clair was attracted by both charges. He wouldn't have wanted a squeaky clean character for the job he had in mind.
Have you talked to Mike Freeman at Strategic Services about him?
No, but that's a good idea.
Dinner tomorrow?
I'm booked. How about the evening after?
Done.
They hung up. Stone called Mike Freeman and was connected immediately.
How are you, Stone?
Pretty good. I want to pick your brain.
Shoot.
What do you know about somebody called Eric Marker?
St. Clair's muscle?
That's the one.
You know he was agency.
That I know.
He applied for a job here when he left the agency, so we did a pretty good workup on him.
And what did you find?
Hang on, let me fire up the computer.
Stone could hear the clicking of a keyboard.
A couple of blots on his copybook, the first a fight in a pub during which he nearly disabled the other guy who wouldn't testify, the second a murder.
The woman he raped? That turned up on his rap sheet.
We concluded that he murdered the woman.
But you couldn't prove it.
Nope. A female body turned up 4 months later in a 55-gallon drum that washed up on a beach in Jersey. Cause of death was a shattered vertebrae that could have resulted from a hanging or the attentions of somebody who was trained in the art of assisting a person to break his neck. A positive identification couldn't be made.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that certainly put us off. We never made him an offer.
How'd he take it?
I don't know. We just wrote him a turndown letter and never heard from him again. Later, I heard he had been lured by Christian St. Clair to assemble a private security group with him as its only client. Frankly, I suspect that Marker had a hand in every shady thing we heard about St. Clair in subsequent years, and now he's running the company.
So I hear.
You know, if he hadn't been sitting a few feet from St. Clair when the explosion happened, he would have been the prime suspect.
I can't argue with that, Stone said. Thanks, Mike. This is all good to know. The two men hung up. Stone called Dino.
Yeah?
I thought you might like to update your file on Marker.
You got more info?
Mike Freeman had some.
Shoot.
4 months after Marker's rape charge, the body of a woman turned up in an industrial drum on the Jersey shore with a broken neck as the cause of death.
It was too far gone for identification.
Not even teeth? The teeth never go away.
Beats me. Mocker had applied for a job at Strategic Services at the time, and Mike figured the body was that of Mocker's accuser, though he couldn't ID her.
Well, that was more than 20 years ago, probably when you and I were sharing a squad car. The news never filtered down. Not that I knew anything about it at the time, anyway. See you soon.
They both hung up. Stone wondered where the remains in the steel drum had ended up. 11. Stone went to his meeting with the Carlsons the next day. The two young men, Niels and Sven, looked enough like their father to have been him at an earlier age, handsome, fit, and comfortable in their skins. Marissa was the female version. They all sat down and coffee was served.
"What have you got for us, Stone?" Paul Carlson asked.
"Essentially, your clinic back," Stone said, "and without doing a deal with the Steel Insurance Group."
"How do we do that?"
Sven asked.
"Your books and collective financial statements show enough liquidity to make an offer to the non-family stockholders 50% larger than the St. Clair offer. If they all want to sell, then you might need to borrow some of the necessary funds, but probably some of them will feel comfortable with the long run."
"Dad," Sven said, "I should speak to our bankers in case we need to increase our line of credit."
"Do that," Paul said. "We think it should be done quickly," Stone said, distributing a package of documents. "Here is a letter to have printed on your letterhead, Paul, and for you to sign. There's also a letter for those wishing to sell to sign, have notarized, and return to receive their money. You should print this as soon as possible and FedEx it to all the shareholders with a return FedEx envelope enclosed. You might be able to get enough of them to agree before St. Clair's deadline expires, when Mocker would probably make a higher offer."
"Is our offer too high?" Niels asked. "Maybe 25% more than St. Clair's might do the trick."
"We think that's what Mocker would offer," Stone said. "And it would be quicker and cleaner to make it 50%. It would be better not to get into a bidding war. The stock's value is probably greater than that."
"What do you say?"
Carlson asked his children. They all responded affirmatively.
"Then let's do it," he said, handing the documents to Sven. "Ask somebody to stay tonight and make the copies. We'll get the packages off tomorrow morning."
Marissa stood up.
"If you will excuse me, I have something I must do."
She shook Stone's hand and left the room.
"Stone," Paul Carlson said, "I want to thank you and tell you how impressed we all are with how quickly you put this plan together."
"I was very happy to help," Stone said.
"I believe we can find some more work for your firm," Carlson said. "We have discussed opening a new division devoted to executive physical exams. Most companies today ask their executives to undergo them, and we think our reputation will serve us well. We have a floor downstairs that we can devote to the operation."
"What a good idea," Stone said. "We'd be glad to help. Why don't I get you together with our managing partner, Bill Eggers, as soon as the stock buyout is resolved, and we'll see how to proceed."
"Wonderful," Paul said.
They all stood and shook hands and went their separate ways. In the outside hallway, Stone found the mahogany elevator door and pressed the button.
"Yes?"
Marissa's voice said on the intercom.
"It's Stone."
The elevator door opened and Stone got on. Upstairs, the door opened into a vestibule where Marissa was waiting.
"Good meeting," she said. "Perhaps Scandinavians are not so demonstrative, but I could tell that Papa was thrilled. And so were the boys."
"I'm glad I could help."
"Come in and let me get you a drink."
She led him into a large living room, paneled in a light wood,
and hung with many pictures, with marvelous city views to the south. She went to a bar.
"What would you like?"
"Knob Creek bourbon, if you have it." She looked.
"I'm sorry, no. I'll have it next time. May I interest you in an aquavit?" she asked.
"Wonderful idea." She opened a freezer and came out with a bottle frozen in a block of ice, found two small glasses, and poured for them. "Skoll," she said. They raised their glasses and tossed back the icy liquid.
"What a beautiful finish," Stone said, tasting the afterglow.
"It's a special aquavit that we have sent over," she said, pouring them another.
Stone felt the warmth spreading up from his belly.
"Where do you live?" she asked.
"In Turtle Bay Gardens," he replied.
"Oh, good," she said. "Within crawling distance."
They tossed back another.
"I think I will hold at this altitude for a while," Stone said.
"Look, I know you've booked a table, but downstairs we have a very fine chef. Why don't I have a smorgasbord sent up?"
"What a good idea."
While she was calling down, he phoned the restaurant and canceled. She came back and nestled beside him on the sofa.
"You know," she said, "I should ask our crew to run down yachts more often."
"I'm quite happy to have undergone the experience, given its results."
"A good business move?"
"An even better personal one."
She smiled and poured them another aquavit. Stone thought that from here in he should sip and not chug a lug.
Dinner arrived in due course, and the waiter placed the large tray on the dining table, set it with china and silverware, and left. They took their seats, and Stone surveyed the array of smoked fishes, sliced meats, hot dishes, breads, and other comestibles. Marissa opened a chilled bottle of Batard Montrachet and poured them glasses.
"You have good taste in wines," Stone said, sipping his approvingly.
"Papa is the wine collector," she said. "I steal from his cellar."
"Well stolen. This is one of my favorites."
"Now," she said, joining him, "I want to hear all about you. Google did not produce sufficient results."
"The short version, born Greenwich Village, attended public schools, NYU and NYU Law School, became infatuated with police work and joined the force, ending up as a long-time homicide detective. Dino, whom you have met, was my partner. Took a bullet in the knee, and the NYPD took the opportunity to unload me. An old law school buddy, who was with Woodman and Weld, advised me to take a cram course, take the bar, and come to work for them. I did so."
"Ever married?"
"Yes, she died not long afterward, murdered by a former suitor."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Children?"
"One son, Peter, now a film director in Los Angeles. One Labrador Retriever, Bob. Your turn."
"Mine is more boring.
Born just down the street, attended Spence, summered in Sweden with my mother. They were divorced when I was 10. Columbia, master's in biology, and Harvard Medical School. Did my internship and residency in internal medicine at New York Hospital right over there. And since then, I've never strayed far from this building."
"I hope you're getting out more these days."
"Every chance I get."
"We must contrive some things to do with your spare time."
She pushed back from the table.
"Perhaps you're aware of the Swedish attitude toward sex?"
"I've heard rumors," Stone replied.
"They are all true,"
she said, taking his hand.
"Come with me."
And he did. 12. Stone awoke alone in a large bed in a darkened room.
"Oh, you're awake,"
Marissa said from across the room, raising a blind part way to admit a stream of bright sunlight.
"Breakfast in half an hour."
She slipped off her robe, giving him a large, Swedish dose of the full frontal view.
We have time to do it again.
He raised his arms, and she came into them. Half an hour later, he heard the doorbell.
Breakfast, she said, grabbing her robe and headed for the front door. Join me.
Stone found a robe for himself draped over a chair, slipped into it, and went into the living dining room. Another smorgasbord, this one with eggs, cheese, smoked salmon, and toasted muffins. They dug in.
You are an excellent lover, she said. Gentle, kind, but assertive and willing to experiment.
I don't believe I've ever been rated that way before, he said.
You have been. You just weren't told. And what about me?
Enthusiastic, affectionate, skillful, and welcoming, he replied. Highest marks. Oh, and I give the Swedish attitude towards sex equally high marks. She laughed.
When will I see you again?
Is this evening too soon? I'm having dinner with Dino and Viv. Will you join us?
Of course. I'll be working a little late. May I meet you at the restaurant?
8 o'clock at Patroon, 160 East 46th Street.
Agreed. How late will we be?
Bring a toothbrush, he replied, and a change of socks. Stone was back at his desk in time to receive a phone call from Ed Rawls.
Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
You left too soon. The Maine weather is glorious. It's getting to be autumn.
Stone groaned.
And I'm stuck here, doing business.
It's business I called about. Yours, not mine. I've heard that Eric Macher is planning to increase his offer for the Carlson Clinic.
You astonish me, Ed.
How do you do it? Intelligence is my chosen craft. I'll give you a hint. There are agency alumni at St. Clair other than Macher.
I should have guessed. Did you hear a number mentioned?
An increase of 25%, Rawls said.
That's good to know. How about when?
As soon as his earlier offer expires.
So he'll wait to see how many bites he gets.
It would make him look too eager to do it now. I should think he's likely to pick up quite a few shares, Ed said, though maybe not enough for a majority.
So he'll up the ante to corral some more.
Macher didn't even know about the offer until after St. Clair's death, but I'm told he's very caught up in it now. He wants the clinic badly. I'm not sure why.
Well, Stone said, it's probably his first deal since taking control.
He has several left over from St. Clair, but this is the biggest one. He badly wants to see the headline in the Wall Street Journal.
I'll see what I can do about getting him a headline, Stone said, though perhaps not the one he'd like.
For Macher, that would amount to a public shaming. He cares desperately about achieving a business reputation for himself.
I don't have a problem with that.
You need to think about this, Stone.
You're against the deal?
No, no, I don't give a shit either way, except for the fun of embarrassing Macher. You just have to understand that if you win, you'll be making a dangerous enemy.
Well, I suppose you don't win many friends resisting hostile takeovers.
Of course not, but this will be of a different order of magnitude, given Macher's background and, above all, his nature. You had better be ready for a hostile reaction.
That's good advice, Ed. Thank you.
The least I can do, Ed said. See ya.
He hung up. Stone hung up, too. It occurred to him that, given Ed's information, it might be better to reconsider how to handle St. Clair's offer. He called Paul Carlson.
Good morning, Stone, the physician said. Did you and Marissa enjoy your evening?
Very much indeed, Stone replied.
I'm so glad. I hope you will forgive her Swedish forthrightness. It has sometimes been a problem for her.
Ah, no problem.
Paul, I've had some new information about the St. Clair offer.
Then I'm anxious to hear it. Federal Express picked up the stockholder documents 20 minutes ago. Several of my staff were up most of the night getting them ready to ship in light of your concern for quick action.
Stone's shoulders sagged, too late for restraint.
Paul, my new information is that Eric Macher is personally deeply invested in his offer for the clinic, and he will be very upset when he hears that he has lost it.
Do we care? Paul asked.
Not really, but I've been advised that we should be prepared for a very strong reaction, possibly a dangerous one.
Carlson was quiet for a moment.
I had not anticipated such a thing. Neither had I, though perhaps I should have.
Do you have some notion of how we should proceed, given this new information?
I believe that for a time we should hire security professionals to ensure the safety of you and your family.
Do you mean bodyguards?
Perhaps more subtle than that. I serve on the Board of Strategic Services, a large part of whose business is personal protection, and they are very, very good at what they do.
What exactly will this mean? Paul asked.
They will want to install people at the clinic, perhaps under the guise of providing some other business service, computer evaluations, perhaps something that will give them an excuse to be close to you. Then they'll blend in. Also, it would be best if you all travel in vehicles supplied and driven by them. They will endeavor to be as unobtrusive as possible.
All right. I'll let the kids know.
When will this start? Before the day is out. I just have to make the phone call to put everything in place.
Then proceed, and thank you for your attention to this.
I will do so immediately, Stone said. He hung up and called Mike Freeman.
13. Mike listened while Stone outlined the problem.
I'll put 2 people with each of them, one to watch the scene, the other to stick close.
Mike, there will be times when the daughter won't need that coverage.
What sort of times?
The times when she's with me.
Are you prepared to go armed at those times and explain to her why you're carrying?
It would be better than having a strange man in my bedroom, Stone replied.
As you wish. I'll put Viv Bichetti in charge of getting a team together. I'll send a team to the clinic to survey the strengths and weaknesses of the place, and I'll have personal protection in place by 5 o'clock today.
Make that 10 tomorrow morning for Marissa, Stone said.
Gotcha. Anything else?
It might be a good idea to put one of your shrinks to the task of disassembling Eric Macher's psyche, with an eye toward predicting his moves.
A thoughtful suggestion. They sometimes complain about not being given enough work. Talk to you later.
Both men hung up. Joan buzzed.
A Dr. Carlson on 1, she said.
Stone picked up the phone. Paul?
Not the first time I've been mistaken for my father, Marissa said.
I was underinformed. I'm sorry.
My late appointment has been canceled. May I come to you for a drink before dinner? I want to see how you live.
I'd be delighted. 7 o'clock, if Swedes are congenitally punctual. 6:30, if they tend to run late.
See you at 7. I have the address.
She hung up.
Stone buzzed Joan.
Next time, tell me which Dr. Carlson, he said, then hung up before she could come back with a snappy reply.
Marissa was punctual. The bell rang as the second hand reached the top of the clock. Stone let her in the front door, and they kissed lightly.
So far, so good, she said. I like the flowers planted outside. Not what you'd expect from a born-again bachelor.
He led her into the living room, where she stopped and performed a slow 360-degree turn.
This is you, but not entirely you, she said. I see a little of an older person. How did you come by this house?
I think perhaps I'd better get us a drink before I tell you that story, because it's a few paragraphs long.
She followed him into the study, looking carefully around.
What would you like to drink?
What was that stuff you asked me for last evening?
Knob Creek bourbon.
Some of that, please, and put this in your freezer.
She reached into one of her two commodious handbags and extracted a bottle of aquavit.
For future occasions?
Certainly, he said,
opening the door and inserting it. Then he poured them both a Knob Creek. She sniffed it, then had a taste, smacking her lips.
Not as bad as I thought it would be, she said.
I'll let Kentucky know you said so. In addition to being sexually liberated, Swedes are also frank.
Germans are frank, she said. Swedes are candid.
I see.
Are these your mother's paintings?
They are. You're very well informed.
I am a researcher by nature.
Is that a Swedish trait? She took a chair.
More a personal one.
Stone sat beside her.
You were born and raised in New York, right?
Yes.
How did you get to be so Swedish?
By way of genetics, since both my parents are Swedish, and by nature, acquired in my summers in that country as a girl. I had many opportunities to compare, and I found Swedes to be better role models than Americans.
In what ways?
First, you were going to tell me the story of how you acquired this house.
Ah, by a rather torturous route. My parents were natives of western Massachusetts, where their own parents were engaged in the weaving of woolen cloth on rather a large scale. The two families were close, and by the time they were teenagers, my father and mother were deeply in love, somewhat to the alarm of their respective parents.
Too young?
That, and my father's ambitions. He was destined for the law at Yale, where generations of Barringtons had matriculated, but he wanted more than anything to be a carpenter and a maker of furniture, which they considered to be beneath their station in life. Then there was the subject of his social and political views,
which were
probably more Swedish than American, very left-leaning. The two young people were forbidden to marry. By this time, my father was professing communism in its purer form. This caused my father's parents to disown him.
How harsh!
It was. Then they eloped, and my mother was disowned by her parents for marrying my father, and the schism was complete. They moved to Greenwich Village, where my mother's gift for painting blossomed, and my father became a handyman, calling door to door at people's houses, toting his toolbox, seeking work and finding enough to allow him to, eventually, acquire his own woodworking shop and to begin thinking about having me. During those early years, they were secretly helped along by my maternal grandmother's widowed sister, her Aunt Eloise, who owned and lived in this house. Eloise helped them most by commissioning my father to make all the doors, bookcases, and wood furniture for the house over a period of years. It became a showcase for him and allowed him to add the word designer to his job title. When Aunt Eloise died in her 90s, she willed the house to me.
How lovely.
It was lovely, but in her later years the infrastructure had aged along with her, so a very thorough renovation was required, and having trained at my father's knee, I did much of the work myself, getting into considerable debt along the way. Then, when I was rescued from the NYPD by Woodman and Weld, I earned enough to pay off the debt and complete the job. Recently, the smaller house next door was for sale, and I bought it to house my secretary, housekeeper, and butler.
You have a butler?
Yes. He was originally a gift from a French friend of mine, who sent him to me for a year. Then I hired him. His name is Fred, and you'll meet him when he drives us to dinner.
This bourbon drink is getting better, she said, glancing at her watch. but I think we should have our second one at the restaurant.
Ever punctual, Stone said, ringing for Fred.
14. Fred dropped them at Patroon, and they found Dino and Viv waiting for them.
Marissa, you remember Dino and Viv from our dinner in Maine?
Of course, Marissa replied, shaking their hands and sitting.
I ordered you both a Knob Creek, Dino said.
Then it's a good thing that Marissa is a new convert to bourbon, or I'd have to drink it myself.
You'll get around to it anyway.
Marissa, Viv said, you spoke so little at our introductory dinner that we hardly got to know you. I'm glad you're here tonight, so we can make up for that. You are very kind, Marissa replied.
Their drinks arrived.
Skull,
Dino said, and they raised their glasses. By the way, Viv said to Marissa, I'm personally handling your security, so please call me if there's something you'd like changed. She pushed her business card across the table. Our company name is Strategic Services. Security? Marissa asked. What does that mean? People with guns, Viv replied, except when you're with Stone. Do you have a gun? Marissa asked Stone.
I do.
I don't see it.
It's cleverly concealed.
This is all very un-Swedish, she replied.
You're in New York, not Stockholm, Viv said. Sometimes we have to take precautions. Stone pushed her drink at her. It will be easier to tolerate once you've had a drink. She laughed and took a big swig of the bourbon.
You see, Stone said, she's thoroughly acclimated.
What does this security entail, besides men with guns? You, your father, and two brothers will have two people each, Viv said. I've arranged for both of yours to be women. It makes things less tense in the ladies' room.
Also, Stone said, except when Fred is driving us, when you leave the clinic, you will always travel in a Strategic Services car.
Is all this really necessary? We very much hope not, Viv said. But we must, in the circumstances, be prepared should it become necessary. For how long?
At least until the stock buyout is complete, Stone said. Perhaps a bit longer.
Is doing business always this dangerous?
It's not about business, Stone said. It's about the ego of one man, a fellow called Eric Macher, who recently took charge of St. Clair Enterprises after the untimely death of Christian St. Clair.
Untimely? Does that mean violent?
Unfortunately, yes. He opened a package that contained a bomb.
Who sent the bomb?
It was an integral part of the package and would have been safe if he had known the procedure for opening it.
I'm sorry. None of this makes any sense at all, Marissa said. Perhaps we should change the subject.
Willingly, Stone said. Marissa was brought up in both New York and in Sweden, and she takes the Swedish part to heart, especially about being candid.
Are the rumors true about Swedish women?
Dino asked. Viv kicked him under the table.
What? I'm just curious.
The rumors are all true, Dino, Marissa said. But Stone and I have already got over that hump. She caught herself, so to speak.
Everybody laughed, and what with the drinks, all tensions disappeared.
Fred drove them home, and Stone took Marissa up in the elevator to the master suite. The intervening floors are guest quarters, Stone explained.
I hope I'm not being relegated to a guest room.
Certainly not. The elevator door opened, and he led her to the master suite.
Oh, this is very nice. And I get my own dressing room and bath?
You do, Stone said, placing her bag inside.
Does this mean we can't undress together? She asked. I like watching you undress.
You are welcome in my dressing room any time, Stone said. It's right over there.
He pointed. She stepped inside her dressing room and undressed, emerging quite naked.
I didn't bring a nightgown, she said.
That's just fine. I would only have to remove it anyway. He stepped into his dressing room and took his clothes off while she watched approvingly.
I think we are a good match, she said. Everything is the right size. You, me, everything.
Stone led her to the bed and pulled back the covers.
Let's see how we fit together. And they did.
The following morning she woke him, and they made love before breakfast, then again afterward. They lay on their backs, panting and perspiring.
It's a good thing you have to go to work, Stone said. I'm not sure I could survive your day off.
She laughed.
You underestimate yourself.
You may overestimate me.
We shall see.
When they had dressed, he walked her downstairs and had a good look around the neighborhood, then put her into the waiting Bentley, and Fred drove off with her. Stone went to his office, through the outside entrance, passing Joan's desk on the way. For future reference, he said, there are four Dr. Carlsons, Paul, the father, Niels and Sven, the brothers, and Marissa.
I'll make a note of that, she said. I suppose we'll be seeing a lot of Marissa.
We will, Stone said, then went to his desk and pretended to be an attorney for the rest of the morning.
Shortly before lunch, he got a call from Ed Rawls.
Good morning, Stone.
Good morning, Ed.
I am reliably informed that news of the counteroffer for the stock has reached the ears of Eric Macher almost as soon as it reached the stockholders.
I believe we are ready for him, Stone said.
I hope to God you're right, Ed said.
Then hung up.
15.
Eric Macher read the note on his desk. He hammered his fist on the buttons before him, and people appeared from everywhere.
What the hell is this? He demanded of them.
Glances were exchanged. Then a young man got brave.
It's in this morning's Wall Street Journal, he said.
Macher grabbed the unread paper on his desk and saw the front page headline.
Someone has offered 50% more than our offer?
The Carlson family has made the offer, the young man said.
What is your name?
Charles Fox, he replied.
How can we stop this?
We can't stop it, Fox said. We can only outbid them.
I had figured on a 25% increase
if we encountered opposition among the stockholders, Macher said.
But 50%?
You could offer 75% more.
Not a chance.
Well, the article does quote an unnamed source as saying that they are likely to get enough shares from this offer for the family to hold a majority, as they once did.
Is the clinic worth 75% more?
Perhaps, Fox said. But if you offer that, the clinic could still top it. It's probably worth more to the family than to St. Clair.
Such a prestigious name, though.
The article says that stockholders will receive the offer this morning, and that the Carlsons have included a FedEx return envelope, so if they respond quickly, there may not even be time to increase our offer.
But our offer doesn't expire for, what, another 2 or 3 weeks?
It doesn't matter. They don't have to respond. They can just take the Carlson's offer.
Macher was visibly fuming.
What should I do?
Fox kept quiet.
Well?
Perhaps look for another investment, Fox said at last.
How long have you been here, Fox?
Mr. St. Clair hired me 2 weeks before he left us.
Why shouldn't I bid higher?
Mr. St. Clair acted unilaterally, Fox said, as I'm told he often did. I've checked, and we don't have any documents that would substantiate what the clinic is worth. Either he had inside information, or he just made a guess. An increase in your offer might do it, or it might not. It's a toss-up.
Mocker thought about it. He did not relish telling the board that he had gambled on a guess about the value of the clinic.
In the circumstances, it's possible, Fox said, that the clinic isn't worth what Mr. St. Clair bid for it. We have no way of knowing.
What did St. Clair hire you to do? Mocker asked.
I think just as a general executive. I've been working at Goldman Sachs since college.
Were you a partner?
Yes, but his offer was so good, I took it.
What are we paying you?
Fox told him.
Mocker was impressed. This kid was earning almost as much as he was before his ascension to CEO.
Well, he said, you'd better earn it. Get out of here, Fox.
Charles Fox left the room and returned to his office next door. He was glad Mocker had not grilled him on his job before Goldman Sachs. He closed his office door, sat down at his desk, removed a burner cell phone from a desk drawer, and pressed a button.
I'm here, Ed Rawls said. I thought you'd like to know that Mocker read the journal piece and hit the roof.
What do you think he'll do?
I'm not sure, but he may just drop out. In any case, by tomorrow, the Carlsons could have a majority again. I did what I could to discourage a better offer, but he could jump either way. I don't know him well enough to predict his actions.
Thanks, kid. Keep in touch.
Sure. Fox hung up. Christian St. Clair had promised him the moon to get him away from Goldman Sachs, but as far as he could tell, St. Clair had not mentioned his hiring to anyone else, let alone told them about the promises he had made to him. Fox had expected to be running the place in a year or two, but now Mocker sat where he wanted to sit, and he was going to have to get the man out before he could advance.
Ed Rawls immediately called Stone Barrington and told him what he'd learned.
That's good news, Stone said. I'm glad we rushed the offer. This guy of yours must be very well placed.
He is very well placed indeed, Ed said.
Come on, Ed. Tell me his name. If you walk in front of a bus, I don't want to lose the guy.
I don't want you communicating with him directly, Rawls said.
I promise not to without your permission, or until you turn up your toes.
I'll think about it, Ed said.
Is your line of communication two-way?
It is. Either of us can communicate at will. I should also mention that he has an in at the Wall Street Journal. That's how the story got on the front page this morning.